and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Architecture, Public Space, and Urban Design, a panel discussion recorded at the Urban in Alaska Conference. Hosted by the University of Alaska Anchorage, first we'll hear from UAA Associate Professor of Public Administration, Dr. Sheila Selkrag, followed by Architect Klaus Meyer, UAA Associate Professor in the Justice Center, Dr. Sharon Shamar, and finally, Director of MTS Gallery, Bruce Farnsworth. This panel discussion on architecture, public space, and urban design was recorded at the Urban in Alaska Conference held at UAA on March 29th.
I want to thank you all for joining us today. I want to especially extend a thank you to my partners, Judy Owens-Manley and Kara Joseph, with the Center for Community Engagement and Learning. This conference and workshop would not have taken place without their partnership and support. I'd also like to thank the Department of Health Sciences, especially Katie Frost, who's in the front there helping us out, the Office of Academic Affairs, and University Advancement, especially Kathleen McCoy, for all their assistance in supporting this event. When I initially set out the call for participation for the Urban in Alaska Conference, there was a faculty member who responded stating, "I'm interested in the conference, but I'm not sure if my research is urban research." So what is urban research? Urban research examines social relations, symbols, and political economies that exist in a place. Urban research makes visible the invisible by highlighting everyday practices, individuals' lived experiences of a place, and how they are influenced by larger social and economic structures. The field of urban research really began in the 1920s and 1930s with the Chicago School researchers who studied the various ecological niches occupied by human groups that formed around the central core of the city. From these early studies, researchers began to investigate the role cities play in relation to its wider region and more so to the wider world. The words city and urban can be used interchangeably, as they likely will be in today's talks. However, when we talk about urban theory in academic circles, what we are talking about is a range of perspectives and interpretations of the urban world that aim to provide a general understanding of city life that goes beyond the local. In Encountering the City, Simon Parker contends that nearly all urban theory deals with one or more aspects of what we might call the four C's of the urban experience: culture, consumption, conflict, and community, all interpreted at their broadest in the broadest sense. So why is it crucial for us to examine a place using urban theory, such as those four C's, and more so, why is it important to examine the urban in Alaska? Historically, urban research has always been present in public policy debates, and at many universities, urban research centers are directly linked to policy institutes. I believe that universities should serve as a resource, providing research, education, and public discussions like the one we are having today, and provide information in a nonpartisan way about what is happening in communities. And while to some of you this process may seem to exist at a theoretical level, I want to say that I believe that urban research is more than an academic value and does not just occur in an academic sphere. I also seriously believe that urban research is closely associated with social justice principles, and thus urban research may and has also promoted collective action. Here at UAA, given that we don't already have an urban research center, we are in a lucky position to innovate. Since we are starting from scratch, we don't have to follow traditional models. We have the choice and opportunity to create an urban research collective or center where the community sets the research agenda, and all forms of knowledge, academic or otherwise, are acknowledged as legitimate. Thus, we truly see today's discussion as a collaboration between the panelists and those of you that are sitting in the audience. The panelists are presenting their research or their knowledge base as a way to initiate a conversation with the audience who can help us move the conversation further. Thus, what's going to happen is we're going to have the panelists present first on each theme, and then following the short talks, we'll open up the conversation to the audience for about 40 or 45 minutes. Our hope is that these presentations will create a space where all individuals can discuss their work, questions can be asked, and collaborations can be formed so that we may not only begin to further influence public policy, but also consider how we can work together to become better advocates for urban Alaska. So I want to, again, thank you all for coming. I realize I didn't even introduce myself, so I'm Bree Kessler, who sent out a lot of emails to all of you, and I'm in the Department of Health Sciences. And I'm going to start introducing your panelists. And again, the panelists will first speak, and then we'll open up the room for conversation. So our first speaker is Sheila Selkrag, and Sheila is Associate Professor of Public Administration here at UAA. And she will be speaking on community vision and genus loci, the spirit of a place.
Good morning. I'm so grateful to Bree for doing this. I've wanted to talk about genius loci for a long time, so I'm glad to have this opportunity. My background is in urban studies, and I have a master's in planning, and I also did graduate work in architecture. And a lot of my training was really focused on the place and focused on the relationship between the experience of the place, the culture, the sustainability of the place, and this kind of holistic sense of how you build places. And I grew up in Anchorage when it felt a little more holistic than it is now, but I'll just breeze you through genius loci. We only have 8 minutes, so I'll be quick. So actually, last night, very late, after 2 o'clock in the morning, I was going through this, and I found this flash, which is this poll came out yesterday, and it was done by the Knight Foundation and Gallup, and what they wanted to understand was the soul of a community. And the reason they wanted to do it, of course, in America, we wanted to know what makes a place a good place to live, and really what promotes economic development. We can't think about soul in America without economic development. And beyond, how do you go beyond just that initial surface? What are the factors that actually make people stay in a place, or what's attachment about in a community? And what was interesting to me was it's very close to what I'm going to be talking about today. They found that they did 26 different communities. They found in each community, for all of them, social offerings, having places to meet and engage, feeling that you could, that there are others that care about you, having a sense of a welcoming community, a place where you have different types of people and diversity, a physical place that's attractive, and green spaces. Of course, if we pulled this room, we'd probably come up with the same. These are really human things. So genius loci is the spirit of the place, and it's been around for, actually the history of this discussion goes a little bit before the U.S. It goes back to Roman times, and genius loci is the spirit of the place. And it was depicted in walls, it was depicted in gargoyles, it was depicted all over Rome and the Roman Empire. And it was actually also this concept existed for the Greeks, but they didn't coin it. And what it really had to do with the sense that we each have a guardian. All things have a guardian. There's a spirit that lies in each of us, and the spirit gives life to people and places. And it really never leaves you, and it determines your character. It determines you who you are, and it determines what the world is like around you. Christian Norberg Schultz wrote a really wonderful book called Genius Loci Towards the Phenomenology of Architecture. And what he did is he really breaks architecture down into a way to understand it in archetypal ways. Like, he recognizes that there are these tall towers throughout time. People are attracted to caves. Houses are set on knolls above the flood, below the snow. There are places that we automatically, for thousands and thousands of years, have been attracted to, close to rivers, but high enough that you're not flooded. Those places he talks about as being rooted really as part of our genius loci, part of our spirit. And there, you know, those realities are very clear in indigenous times, but they're also this top picture is of an African village, and it's next to the sand. I mean, you can see that place, you can understand that place, that spirit of that place is in those houses. We can see it in Ketchikan, we can see it in our indigenous history here. And we can, you know, see it in the Romans, who had many, many people to house, and so they created a great place. And that place really not only gave people an identity, but it also made Rome a place. Norberg Schwartz talks about about genius loci is really draws from Martin Heidegger. And Martin Heidegger is kind of an interesting character. He is very difficult to read. I hated reading him, but I can tell you he talks about Dasein, which is it's what it is to be authentic as a human being. It's kind of like the peak of Maslow's triangle, you know, the actualized self. How do we become the actualized self? And he said we fall in and out of the actualized self. And the actualized self is really rooted in a sense of care or being in the world. And Dasein means care. It means it implies a relationship. And as soon as you have a relationship, what emerges are possibilities to manifest. So places actually play a role in that relationship. You look at a place, you can imagine something great. It gives your life meaning. And the meaning of any object consists of the relationship to other objects. It consists of what the object gathers. And there's this idea, if you think about the places of spirit, it's gathering us. We're gathering there and it's gathering us. A thing is a thing by virtue of what it gathers. So Schultz refers to dwellings, and dwellings is rooted in Heidegger. And Heidegger talked about man dwells to orient himself, to identify himself in the environment. And you know, this house at the top is, it's a downtown house. That house has gathered, it gathers people, it's got gathered art, it's that yard gathered vegetables for many, many, many years. These chairs against the green wall is a doctor's waiting room in Mexico, and it really speaks to the place. It's in the shade. You actually know that place. You can tell a lot about that place just by looking at it. You know, the Ponte Vecchio is a place that people gathered to cross the bridge, so there's stores. The bridge gathered the stores. And, you know, here's a Muldoon picnic. You know, you give us a green place in Muldoon, and we gather, and we have the capacity to make it a place that's not just a field of grass. To have a place in common means to share the experience of the local character. And the interesting thing about local character is that it gathers itself. That's an African community, and it's a very poor, but if you look at what's gathering there, there's clothes, there's kids, there's paths, there's housing. The picture of the graveyard is Point Hope. It's gathered tusks. It becomes a place. It has a sense of history. It gathers the past, and it kind of gives you an idea of the future and how valuable life is. And a Japanese garden has the same quality. It's tranquil. It reaches out for more. And in Anchorage, we gather on 4th Avenue. It's our very best street. It's narrow. It has sidewalks. There aren't cars speeding back and forth. Lots of things happen on 4th Avenue. People are actually on 4th Avenue. So there's a man named William White who for years talked about open spaces and the power of open spaces. And I'm going to have to speed up because I'm running out of time. And that spaces actually by their nature gather, and people are attracted to where people are, and people actually are who they are because they are attracted to those places. And in Anchorage, we have a lot of good gathering places, actually. But there's some elements that White talks about: parks, plazas, public spaces. We're all doing pretty well in those, but where we really are challenged is streets. And he talks about how it seems hard to build a bad place, but we've been managed to build some bad places in Anchorage. And then the streets probably are the thing that lack our character. One point I want to make before I close, because I'm running out of time, is that we actually have a wonderful spine in Anchorage. It was a spine that was born in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We've actually overlaid that spine, but with pretty unhealthy skin. Anchorage's surface, if you go down the road, looks bad. It looks like we're poor. It looks like we don't care. But the beauty is that we actually have the soul here. We have our trails. We have our structure. And the work that lies ahead of us is really about redefining. So there you go. The spirit's strong, the leadership has lost, and the implementation slow.
Our next speaker, Klaus Meyer, is an architect and Alaska Design Forum board director, and he's going to talk about Lost Anchorage, architecture in the wild.
So I want to talk about, actually it was Lost Anchorage. I think the T got added there at some point, but So I come in peace, but I do want to, you know, start a conversation here, and I'm actually interested in the conversation with all of you rather than, you know, presenting some ideas that are all set in stone. So the view that we would like to take is a little upside down. Like most people, you know, we barely even make it on the map, and I think most Americans even don't know where Alaska is and how big it is and all of that. So sometimes it's healthy to step back and take a different viewpoint. So we prefer this one where you can actually see, you know, if you follow that 61 degree or 60 degree north all the way around, there's actually some really great places on the globe. You know, there's Helsinki, there's Stockholm, there's Oslo, there's St. Petersburg, there's all these great northern cities that I think Anchorage should be part of that. And so that's part of what we're trying to do. We do have very great assets, and I think that's our wilderness up here. Anchorage is situated like very few other places in the world. We have a world-class setting, and I think we don't really, like Sheila was mentioning, we don't really tap into that if you look at the urban part of Anchorage. I mean, what people like is the parks, you know, like Sheila's mom was instrumental in the park system. And I think those are really great assets for Anchorage that as we develop Anchorage, we should tap more into it. And here's, everybody probably knows that quote, which is very famous. And, you know, if you drive out along Tudor or Muldoon Road, you know exactly what he's talking about. And there have been some changes, but maybe not enough. And then I think along the coastal trail, you will find statements like this. And I think it's a sign that, you know, speaks to what is going on here in the city. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, a lot of places look the way they look. And so there's a book by Alex McLean and Julie Campoli that is called Visualizing Density. And I think density is one of the issues that we have to tackle. This is Las Vegas, a city just in the desert. And you can see that's not necessarily the density that we want to shoot for, but you know, if people talk about density, they always come up with the most horrible examples. But you can make density in a good way, and so to just visualize what our density is, this is a picture of Phoenix, Arizona. You know, there's one core, and then pretty much everything around it is very much like Anchorage. And Phoenix has a density of like 1,700 per square mile, whereas Anchorage is like at 150. So I think when people in the community tell you about Anchorage is about to run out of land, that's like one statement that within city government and the development community you always hear. I can just laugh, you know. It's like, we're at the density of 150 per square mile, and you know, Boston has like 1,700 or so. And there's some really nice places in Boston. I think everybody would love to live there, you know. So I think we have a long way to go. And so here are some examples from one of the rock stars of architecture these days, Bjarke Ingel, his big group. He seemed to win every big competition these days. He really has a way to explain architecture to common people, and I think that's one of our issues. The profession has an issue of how to communicate the issues of the built environment to the public at general. And so Bjarke does a really nice job. This housing project on the right, for instance, he's talking about using different functions within a housing complex. So, and I'm not advocating that we should be doing this, but I think there are good examples of how we could be smarter about it. So there's parking on the first level or below level. Then there's some sports hall. You know, there's different functions that don't necessarily need the daylight. And then on top, towards south, there are lots of apartment and different living arrangements. And so I think that's something we could improve here as well. You know, do some more different use types buildings. So here's another example. This comes because Denmark is flat, so they always try to make a mountain, and obviously we don't have that problem. But the principles are nice, and so that's why I'm showing it here. You know, to try and see how else can you do it instead of having everything separated out, and then you create the problem of how do you get from one thing to another. You're spreading things out. So with a density that's higher, you can all of a sudden utilize the city much better. And so here's another diagram that he's proposing, basically. What the big thing in renewable energy right now is going out into the community, having community-wide systems that it's not just looking at one project, but you can look at the whole city in the same way, that you can integrate different energy sources and you're sharing in between those. Then here's another example I want to show you, just in terms of research in urbanity, what's going on right now. We had a couple weeks ago, we had a guest from MIT, Carlo Ratti. He's the leader of the Sensible City Lab at MIT, and they're doing a lot of research in terms of what can you do these days, and you know, how do you map, how do you become and understand the city in a different way. And now, because everybody has a cell phone on them, we're having all these measuring tools at our fingertips, and so they are doing various projects where they can actually use that information in real time to inform the city planning. With the Copenhagen Wheel project, where basically the mayor of Copenhagen approached him to say, okay, we want to do a bike sharing project, and how can you help us do this? And so they came up with a wheel that is sort of like a hybrid bike, where you're pedaling, but then at some point you get also energy back. And while you're doing that, in the wheel there are also sensors. And so, for one thing, you can see actually, you can map the pollution. You know, at the top there's the CO2 level, the NOx level. You can map noise. You can map open spaces. And so in real time, you can actually map the city in a very different way that can be very meaningful to how we lay out cities. And I think those are great examples. And Carlo was actually very interested in maybe looking at Anchorage, and I suggested we meet with the mayor, but that hasn't happened. But I think it would be interesting to bring that kind of thinking to Anchorage and see what we could do for our example here. Here's another project that they have done with the Guggenheim Lab in Berlin, basically where they had some security cameras and they have some tracking functions on them. And again, so they can use this technology to see how people use public space. You know, we always hear the stories about the architects proposing, oh, this is, you know, how we're going to use this park and blah, blah, blah. But the follow-up is really a lot of times not there. And so with this, you can actually say, okay, so how is this really working, you know, or is it not working? And then we can change public space around. I think in the U.S., the public space is such a big you know, dangerous place. I mean, we have to, you know, be really careful about it. I think technologies like this would help us to explore and maybe become more comfortable with the idea of, yes, there are shared spaces, and we need those. And so I think Bree was saying I'm running out of time, so I'm looking forward to the discussion. Thanks.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans at the Urban in Alaska Conference. Recorded on March 29th, first you heard from UAA Associate Professor of Public Administration Dr. Sheila Selkrag on community vision and genius loci, the spirit of place. Followed by Architect and Alaska Design Forum Board Director Klaus Meyer on Lost Anchorage, Architecture in the Wild. This panel discussion on the topics of architecture, public space, and urban design was recorded at the Urban in Alaska Conference hosted by UAA on March 29th.
Our next speaker is Sharon Schmar, and she is an associate professor in the Justice Department here at UAA, and she's going to speak on conflict over public space, responses to chronic public inebriates in Anchorage.
All right, well, so I'm going to be talking about conflict over public space, in particular sort of as a case study. I'm going to talk about chronic public inebriates in Anchorage. We'll just, hopefully you can all hear me. Okay, so when we have public space, we're all contributors to it, we all pay taxes in some fashion, and so in theory we should all get to use it, and we should also have equal, you know, rights to use it. But in reality, certain user groups seem to have more legitimate claims to use the space than others. So, and I'm going to show you some examples of activity in public spaces that we would consider legitimate and that we would consider illegitimate. So we have couples in a park, legitimate. Homeless people sleeping in a park, illegitimate. People hiking in a wilderness area, legitimate. People camping in a wilderness area, illegitimate. Two guys on a bench talking, legitimate. Guy sleeping on a bench, illegitimate. And then in terms of use of sidewalks, cafes, planters, other forms of commercial activity on sidewalks, legitimate. John Martin, downtown Anchorage, illegitimate. All right. So this, you know, I came to Anchorage from New Jersey, and I had the real fortune of moving into Fairview when I moved here. People said, oh, a horrible neighborhood. I was comparing it to Newark, New Jersey, so it seemed pretty great. But, you know, I started really focusing on this chronic public inebriate issue because people seemed to be obsessed with it. And fundamentally, it seemed to me to be a conflict over the use of public space. We look at certain types of people, and we say, these are not legitimate users of public space. If they have what I've termed unsightly, if they are unsightly, which is very much a value-loaded statement, but they're disheveled, they look kind of maybe acting a little strange, they really freak us out. And we expect that the police will do something about it. And I'll talk in a little bit here about why we really can't have the police do very much about these kinds of problem behaviors in public space. So who are the chronic public inebriates? In Anchorage, we're talking about a small subset of the homeless population. They are, however, for homeless services providers, a bit of an issue because they are the public face of homelessness. When you drive down the street and you see, the chronic public inebriates hanging out, you say, oh, that's the homeless people. You don't see all of the people who are living in motels and couch surfing and so on. So it's really a small subset, maybe under 10% of Anchorage's homeless population. But they are big, big users of social services. So dealing with this population is a really important public policy, in my mind, a priority, because there are real tremendous cost savings. A lot of these folks are dually diagnosed. They have mental illnesses. A lot of them have traumatic brain injuries. They use the alcohol to self-medicate. So this is a map showing the location of a call for service code with the Anchorage Police Department data. It's called drunk transport. This is when they're called to a scene and they have to transport an extremely inebriated person either to the hospital or to the sleep-off center. And you can see, not sure if this is the, oh yeah, so it's concentrated in the downtown area, a little bit over here, Mountain View and Spinard, and then there's a little pocket down here of the Diamond Center. The most common sites for these places are close to social services, close to liquor stores, close to public transportation, and close to panhandling locations, which is why you tend to see concentrations at large intersections. The police can't really do much. It's not illegal to loiter. A lot of people think, oh, just round them up and arrest them. You can't do that. People have protections under the Bill of Rights, and the Supreme Court has verified this. It's not illegal to be drunk in public. But what the police will do is wait until someone steps into a roadway. Can't be drunk in a roadway. And then they'll pick you up and they'll take you into what's called a non-criminal hold under Title 47 of the state statutes. It allows you to take someone who is a danger to themselves or others temporarily and put them into a custodial situation. Not illegal to sleep or lie down in public. It's a very interesting ruling recently from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out of based on a case in Los Angeles where the Los Angeles police were arresting people for sleeping in public. And the court said, sleeping is a biological function. You cannot arrest people for doing a biological function unless you provide a bed for every single homeless person. Then you can start arresting people. Not feasible from a policy standpoint. So traditional policing tactics are ineffective. So just quickly go through what has been done in Anchorage. Disruption of preferred environment. So one of the things that I focused on in my research was 13th and Gamble. What the police did there was they did a lot of field interviews. It was basically when you stop someone, ask them questions, ask for ID, run them for wants and warrants. Not surprisingly, a lot of these chronic public inebriate folks have wants and warrants out, even though for the most part they're for fairly minor crimes. They're not hardcore violent offenders, even though they may be scary. They're generally not really a danger to people. But what this had the effect of doing was pushing the chronic public inebriates away from that location and into other spots around the city, particularly South Addition, which really upset the people in South Addition who were not used to having these sorts of fellow citizens in their communities. But it started to raise public awareness. If these social problems are just concentrated in certain parts of the city, which they often are because of public policy decisions, then it's very easy for us all to say, it's not my problem, it's Fairview's problem, it's Mountain View's problem, it's Spinard's problem, and then carry on. The other thing the police have been trying to do without much success is try to identify liquor stores that sell to chronic public inebriates and say, hey, stop selling to these hardcore users of services, the frequent flyers. Not all liquor stores are willing to do that. So 13th and Gamble, a real problem dealing with that area because we've got this little stone wall over here, great height for sitting, by a bus stop. So very hard for the police to say, hey, what are you doing here? Well, I'm just waiting for the bus. You've been waiting for the bus for 3 hours. Very difficult to deal with. So it's an urban design issue to some extent. And also this area is, kind of untended warehouse property adjacent to this area and lots of places. Here's a guy passed out on the loading dock. Here's where people drop their furniture off at the recycling center. It's not a newspaper, but still they bring their mattresses there and people sleep on them. People sleeping under cargo trucks. People sleeping here in a kind of area in the alley. So something that we do for environmental modification in this city, we have been systematically removing public amenities from our streetscapes. Okay? In some places, we've got nice bus shelters like this. It's a nice long bench. A modification on the bench is this, where you can't lie down on it. And then lately what they've done in Fairview is they've taken out all the bus shelters and they put these leaner bars up. So you can kind of rest on them, but you can't, unless you're really tall, lift your feet off the ground or else you're going to tumble over the back of it. Okay? So it does not encourage people hanging around for a long time. Now, William White, who you've heard about already today, he had an idea for public space, and he said, how about instead of making it less attractive, we make it more attractive, so that in addition to the street inebriates and those the undesirables using the space, we also have a lot of so-called legitimate users using the space. So it's not like we need to get these folks off the street. Their impact is lessened considerably as the ratio of legitimate to illegitimate user increases. Okay. I was going to talk about Fairbanks Park here, but I'm not sure I have time, so I'm going to skip through that. But essentially, this was a park that had a lot of inebriates hanging out until a fence was put up that blocked their access. So it's a very simple design fix. It returned the park back to the so-called legitimate users instantly. Right? And nobody had to be rehabilitated. Nobody had to be arrested. So just real quick, if I can get another minute, maybe. Okay. One thing that the Anchorage Police Department is doing is they've worked with the prosecutor, the municipal prosecutor, and they're now much more aggressive with enforcing trespassing people from parks. But not just because they're disheveled and kind of scary looking, because they're actually doing certain behaviors. The prosecutor has actually worked with APD, so they now have a list of things that the person has to be doing, illegal things in parks or in public transit, to be trespassed. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about Carluck Manor here. This is an example of a Housing First project. You probably, if you're gathering, most of you here are kind of aware of what goes on in the city, so you probably know about Carluck Manor. It's the first example of Housing First in Anchorage. This is a model that's been pretty rigorously tested in other sites in Seattle, found to be a big success. I expect that the evaluation here that's ongoing will have kind of similar findings. It's a great way to cut down on the demands that this population places on public services, and then to reduce conflict in public space. So, all right, thank you.
Sharon, our next speaker is Bruce Farnsworth. He's a writer and community organizer and the founder and director of the MTS Gallery in Anchorage from 2005 to 2011. He's a member of the art group Light Brigade Core 4. He is talking on estate and time.
Well, now at least I know the real reason I was invited to be on this panel, because I've been trying to figure that out. It's to provide the counterpoint to Sharon's talk on the good side of public inebriation. But my name's Bruce Farnsworth, and I'm a member, as Bree said, of founding member of, I guess we call it the Core Four members of the art group Light Brigade. Just a quick disclaimer, I originally made a little PowerPoint style set of bullet points to use as an outline for this talk, and touching on all the ideas I wanted to cover in this, and I practiced it a couple nights ago, and it was 3.5 hours long, so I decided to write it out. And since Bree didn't comply with my request for a teleprompter, I'm going to just have to do this old school paper and microphone and reading glasses. I was asked not too long ago by somebody in the media to provide a one-sentence description of the Light Brigade. I grew up reading Kerouac and Faulkner, so I can write a really long sentence. Here's what it is. The all-purpose one-sentence Light Brigade description. The Light Brigade is an independent group of loosely affiliated designers, writers, choreographers, composers, visual, media, and performance artists whose mission is to forever change the way our fellow citizens see and relate to familiar places in their everyday environment by planning, designing, and executing creative, time-based, site-specific urban art interventions on the local landscape and built environment, using the full assortment of tools our consortium members possess, dance, lighting, illusion, visual and social media, augmented reality, poetry. The intellectual seeds of my personal interest in the Light Brigade mission go back to a trip I made just after I turned 40. I was born pretty much smack dab in the middle of the 20th century. Until the final decade of the last century, my entire conscious life and much of my imaginative life was dominated by the Cold War. And then quite suddenly, the collapse of the Soviet Empire, which I define as the USSR and its satellite countries made up the Warsaw Pact and Yugoslavia, officially began in 1989 and was all but complete by 1991. Those of you who weren't adults at that time will have to take my word for it that it was breathtakingly fast. I went to tour the former Iron Curtain region of Central Europe in the fall of 1996 to see for myself how the transformation was coming along. During my stay in Prague, I met a group of artists from Ljubljana who were on holiday. During several late-night absinthe binges, we talked about life and art at length. They told me we were indoors. They told me about an art group they were part of just 5 years earlier and how when Slovenia declared its independence from the Soviet Empire, thus fulfilling their group's mission, they suddenly faced an existential crisis. What does an insurgency do after it succeeds? I came away from these discussions appreciating two things. Both of the two main narratives to explain the sudden collapse of the communist monolith were wrong, or at least gravely insufficient. The dumber of the two, I like to call it the Texas Ranger narrative, holds that Ronald Reagan brought it about. The second and slightly more sophisticated analysis holds that the arms race bankrupted the Eastern Bloc's economies and so down they went. The real story is that if there was a single prime factor that caused this mighty empire to collapse, it was rock and roll. Too simple, I know. So let rock and roll stand for the entire multifaceted incursion of a dissident youth culture that began in the West in the late 1950s and spread like a gallon of spilled paint. What happened to the poor Soviet Empire is the same thing that happened to that poor guy in Florida that was so much in the news a few weeks ago when his lovely house and yard fell straight down into a sinkhole. The pictures that clogged the media sphere were of the house, all busted up down in the hole. But the image that was stuck in my head was of the place 1 minute before it collapsed. It's so compelling an image because it's a perfect metaphor for my purpose today. Because it was a completely unassailable, completely convincing, yet completely false scene. There you are, having your neighbors over for barbecue and croquet or badminton year after year, and the rhododendron are thriving, and the lawn is the perfect shade of green, and it all looks picture-perfect up there on the surface. What could not be seen was the underground incursion of water that ate away the limestone substructure of the neighborhood, just the way the rebellious youth art and culture movement dissolved the moral, spiritual, and cultural platform supporting the states of Eastern Europe. By the mid-80s, there wasn't enough of a loyal next generation to hand over the keys to the estate. Kaput. The second thing I came away from these late night in Broglio appreciating is that artists must pay attention to the situation they exist within and find an art-making practice relevant to it. Like our comrade artist from Ljubljana that I met, we inhabitants of the early 21st century face a similar identity crisis. We have all the tools in our toolbox to start to bring about the actualization of a long-standing project of artists of the modern era, the unity of humankind. Now, here's why I think I can get away with saying that to a room full of people who are not, at least right at this moment, on drugs. The moral, spiritual, and philosophical rationale for all of the artificial barriers and boundaries that have separated us in the past have been worn away like Floridian limestone. Religion, national borders, race, class distinctions, these forces that once burned so bright are all like the emanations reaching the Hubble telescope from long ago burned out stars. Mere echoes and residue, still possessing heat and light, yes, but having no source. This process has been underway for some time now. It started slowly with the victory of the Copernican over the Aristotelian model of the universe. Since then, a steady stream of markers have arisen along the roadside, one after another, the pace accelerating as the decades rushed by. Highlights include the scientific obliteration of the theory of race, the epiphany-inducing image from outer space of the blue planet, the ascendancy of abstraction and conceptualism in the art world, and very recently the Occupy Wall Street movement exposed the brittle nature of class as a stabilizing pillar of the status quo. And then finally, the Arab Spring demonstrated that we hold the tools to rally a global constituency literally in the palms of our hands. All the tools, as I said before, are now in the toolbox. It is at this point, as I discuss these ideas with friends, that I am frequently challenged, especially by women who are arguably the most at risk from a violent counteroffensive, by this question. If this theory is valid, why are we seeing a massive coalescing and organization of the forces of the old paradigm? How do you explain the radical backlash epitomized by the assault on progressivism in the form of attacks on women's autonomy, a rash of openly expressed racism, the assault on science and reason, the hue and cry for austerity that scapegoats the poor, the proliferation of kooky conspiracy theories, and perhaps most bizarrely, the resurrection of Ayn Rand? To me, all of this sound and fury should be heard as a death rattle. The final lurching spasms of a mortally wounded beast, a zombie culture, if you will. Given my perception of this state of affairs as one in which we ought to start acting as though the world has changed, even if it really is only in the process of change, I am excited to participate along with my fellow light brigadiers in an art practice that is communal and collaborative, non-hierarchical, and most salient of all, time-based, which is to say largely ephemeral in nature. The title I gave to this presentation is A State in Time. It's a way of referring to the theory underlying the Light Brigade's growing body of work. It also refers to what it is that connects the urban in Alaska with the urban in Kinshasa and Cartagena and Tallinn. Those of us who live in cities and do so by choice are connected to other urban dwellers the world over based on the time in which we live. No longer bound to place in the old nationalist sense. No longer citizens strictly of a country. No longer prisoners of superstition, custom, or cult. We are citizens of a time, countrymen of this particular time, inhabitants of now, residents of a state of mind, if you will, a state in time, if you will, excuse me. While every city has its unique regional geographical issues and features, urbanites everywhere share a culture. We tend to know each other's what's what and who's who. We sample and consume each other's food, music, slang, fashion, combine it with our own, and run with it. I first heard the band Arcade Fire in 2004 on a bootleg compilation CD I bought in a tiny little record store called Boom Boom Records on a side street in Phnom Penh. This, I think, is the new world. And the first task of the new world order, we, the frontline workers in the trenches of epistemology and expression, is to grapple with the fact that the ultimate utopian aspiration of art social practice for the past 100 years has essentially been accomplished. The erosion of the foundation of false boundaries, borders, and barriers, separating humans in one part of the world from those of us in another, thus creating the conditions for the unifications of the citizens of our time. So what does an insurgency do after it succeeds? Like my newfound friends from Ljubljana Art Group Irwin, who told me about facing that existential question in 1991, we face it on a worldwide level today. Sometimes we like to say that the work of the Light Brigade is in the hacker tradition. What I think that means is that our task in this environment is to act like what I just said is true, even if on the surface it doesn't appear to be. Even if the house is still standing, the barbecue is still grilling, the lawn and the rhododendron still grows, and the subdivision looks the same as it did yesterday, we don't need to rage against the machine or stick it to the man. That was yesterday's assignment. Artists today should ignore the machine, circumvent the man, and get about the business of forging an enlightened, universal, urban hacker consciousness that holds that art making, like the broader human project, is an experiment, the only goal of which is to keep the experiment going. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans at the Urban in Alaska Conference. We just heard from Bruce Farnsworth, writer, community organizer, founder, and director of the former MTS Gallery in Anchorage. His talk was titled A State in Time. Before Bruce, you heard from UAA Associate Professor in the Justice Center, Dr. Sharon Shamar, on
Conflict Over Public Space, Responses to Chronic Public Inebriates in Anchorage. In addition to Sheila Selkrag and Klaus Meyer, who you heard from in the first half of the show, all four participated in the panel discussion on architecture, public space, and urban design, recorded at the Urban in Alaska Conference on March 29th. Following their individual presentations, the panel responded to questions from the audience.
Okay, the question was, is the goal of Carluck Manor to reduce municipal services, to make life better for the people living in Carluck Manor, or to make life better for other people, I think was the question. And yes, yes, and yes. I think it has multiple goals. Legitimate, yeah, yeah. Now, I use the term legitimate and illegitimate. I mean, it's not like what I truly believe. Although I have to say, living in Fairview, I kind of have developed more of I've been dismayed in the change in my views about things, actually, since I've lived there. I'm a lot more closed-minded about public behavior than... Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I've become a much more cynical person and a much more... less open to public behaviors than I was before I lived there. Does that answer your question? I think, yeah.
So they discovered that the demand for housing in Anchorage is really focused on single-family housing, which restricts, of course, density in housing. And secondly, that the pro formas for large-scale, over five-story housing complexes in Anchorage just didn't pencil out. The economics of creating such a large housing area didn't work out. And so my question to you is, what would you suggest could break down the barriers to both of those subjects, both the pro forma side of the actual economic side of high density housing and the social demand for high density housing?
I have to wave my hands anyhow. Well, actually, I'm pretty familiar with that issue because our comprehensive plan really focused on increasing density. And it focused on increasing density with a kind of new urbanism model where we would have shops on the lower floors. You've seen it across the country. It's emerged. We thought of it, actually, and our plan was used as a teaching document at the University of Washington and UCLA, but we didn't do it. And the issue is that how do you use your land? And the Title 21, and I don't mean to sound bitter, but that was just trashed. It was just genuinely trashed, actually did a mass racial land thing so that if you provided some green space, you could go higher. The reason people are wanting single family housing is because we do multiple family housing terribly in this town. We actually create places where in some cases people turn the key and their house is worth less, not more. They don't, that housing isn't appreciating. It takes landscaping to make a place appreciate. It takes that, genius loci, a sense of place. And we've just done a terrible job because we've been convinced that we don't have the money to do it, which is a strange thing to say in a state like ours. So the way you go about doing that is you increase the mass of the building, but you reduce the parking. We've already done studies that we have more parking than we need. You begin, if you really want to move that way, look at Honolulu. How many million people live in Honolulu? It's about the same size as the Anchorage Bowl. I mean, it's totally possible. And I can tell you, if it pencils out in Honolulu, where you have to import things even further than Alaska, it can pencil out here. And the work that was done on the on Title 21 actually went through an analysis of whether it would cost more to do a better job, and it doesn't cost more to do a better job. We have some trade-offs. The thing this issue got down to the existing power structure in this town just doesn't want to be told what to do. And so people now are not even buying single-family homes here. They're buying them in Mat-Su because they're cheaper and they can get more for their money. So it's just a matter of public policy. It's just a matter of a commitment. And it's a matter of doing a good job. Somehow, places all over the country have been able to do it. I'm going to say one last thing. The president of the Home Builders Association, when I was planning director, fought a whole lot of things we were doing. And then he went to Seattle. And he came back and he said, you know, Seattle's great. They have a lot of rules and regulations. You just have to follow them and you can get things done. So part of it is the internal capacity to make it easy.
I would say, you know, maybe we don't have to look at five-story housing to begin with. Cook Inlet Housing has done some really nice projects in Mountain View where they've done like three-story housing with some commercial on the first floor level. And I think if we grow these small projects and can show that they work for us, maybe there's a way to do more of those. But, yeah, I would also question whose economics didn't pencil out, you know, why, you know, at what kind of cost are we looking at? It's definitely doable. We know it's doable, and we know we can do a good job. Like Sheila is saying, you know, there's ways to do housing in a good way. So, yeah, I think it's a mindset more than anything else.
I have one last comment. And that is that the cost that they're evaluating is the immediate cost. The long-term cost of building terrible places are creating bad outcomes in children's lives. And that whole sense of the genius loci is being part of something. People don't know each other. There's no common place for people to meet. We end up losing a sense of a real community. When you build a great place to live, great things happen in them. And Anchorage is seeing an increase in crime in high-density areas. I mean, you can spot it. And it has to do with the nature of the place. And if we change the nature of the place, behavior changes. There's lots of documentation on that.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans at the Urban in Alaska Conference. Today you heard one of three panels at the conference focusing on architecture, public space, and urban design. The audience had the opportunity to ask questions following presentations by UAA Associate Professor of Public Administration, Dr. Sheila Selkrag, Architect Klaus Meyer, UAA Associate Professor in the Justice Center, Dr. Sharon Shamar, and finally, Director of MTS Gallery, Bruce Farnsworth. Special thanks to Kathleen McCoy over at UAA, who recorded this week's program. The Urban in Alaska Conference, hosted by UAA, was recorded on March 29, 2013. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.